Okay, welcome everyone. Let's get started. Hi, my name is Lauren DiNincenzo. I'm an assistant professor of organizational behavior at the LeBeau College of Business at Drexel University. Drexel is committed to developing critical thinkers, innovative leaders, and effective collaborators through our variety of educational and executive training programs. We see firsthand at Drexel the amazing impacts that sessions like these have on advancing women in the workplace. And Drexel University is a proud sponsor of the Pennsylvania Conference for Women. I'm thrilled to be here at such an amazing conference and have an opportunity to learn and meet so many talented females. One of my favorite things about this conference are the practical tools and advice that each session offers. So far, every session that I've attended has been inspiring and left me feeling empowered and excited about tomorrow. And this session promises to be no different. Now, not many sessions get the encore slot, so right away you know that you're in for a treat. We have an amazing hour in store. Anne Grady is here to deliver her advice, harness resilience, to catapult yourself forward. Anne Grady is a best-selling author, two-time TED speaker, and a self-proclaimed truth bomb dropper. She is a leading expert on communication, leadership, emotional intelligence, and resilience. Anne's talks are truly inspiring, and one of my favorite things is she brings humor to all of the ideas that she's about to present to you all today. Be prepared to laugh, learn, and be inspired. So without further ado, please put your hands together for Anne Grady.
Hello, hello. Awesome. Well, I'm going to jump right in. I've got a question for you, and it's one that I want you to take very seriously. So by a show of hands, how many of you have survived the worst thing that has ever happened to you? Oh my gosh, we have a head start on this resilience thing, but follow-up question, how many of you have ever doubted your ability to do it at the time, to just make it through? Yeah, I know I have. I have been fiercely determined since the day I was born. I went on a hunger strike until I could tie my own shoes when I was two. My elementary school teacher, Mrs. Rock, told my parents that if I didn't learn to relax, I'd have an ulcer by middle school. And by my freshman year of high school, I had a strategic plan mapped out for my life. I was going to go to college, get a master's degree, get married at 26, have my first child at 28, my second child at 32. I had it all figured out, and I wasn't the least bit high strung. So things were going according to plan. I went to college, I got a master's degree, I got married at 26, I had my son Evan 2 days after my 28th birthday, and I thought, clearly, I am on track. I have mastered this adulting thing. Until I didn't. I knew something wasn't right when I was pregnant. Evan would kick so hard, I would literally drop to the ground. My doctor joked that he'd be a soccer player. When he was born, the nurse came into the room and said, "Honey, I've been doing this 35 years, and in all that time, I have never seen a baby this angry," which is always what a first-time mom wants to hear, right? He cried all day and all night, and I took him to multiple doctors. I didn't know what was wrong. He just got crankier and crankier. And when he was 18 months old, my husband left. So there I am, a single mom with a cranky baby who cried constantly with no answers. And I went to every doctor I could imagine, but Evan continued to escalate. And when he was 3 years old, he tried to kill me with a pair of scissors. By the age of 4, he was on his first antipsychotic. Now, I went to neurologists, psychiatrists, psychologists, acupuncturists. Hell, I took him to a spiritual healer. Nobody could tell me what was wrong. And right around that time, I had the great fortune to meet my current husband, Jay. Well, that makes it sound like there's going to be another one. He's the only one. Like, he's it. And that is his daughter, Riley. So technically, I had my second child at 32. And this became my crazy family, but unfortunately, Evan continued to escalate. And when he was 7 years old in the second grade, we got a call from his teacher. And she said, "Ann, Evan's kicked a hole in the sheetrock. He's taken out an electrical cord and tried to strangle himself. He's threatened to kill 2 students. He's dislocated a teacher's fingers, and if you can't be here in the next 10 minutes, we have to call the police. Now, Jay and I picked him up, and we drove to Dallas. I live in Austin. We left our home in Austin, drove 3 hours to Dallas, and we checked him into the pediatric psych unit of Children's Medical Center, and we spent the next 2 months living at the Ronald McDonald House while Evan underwent psychiatric inpatient treatment. Evan is an amazing kid, and I love him more than I thought it possible to love another human being. How many of you are parents? A lot of you, yeah. So you know when your kids are hurting and there's nothing you can do to help them, it is like the most helpless, awful feeling. And people kept telling me, Ann, you're so brave. And I thought, I am terrified. And they said, Ann, you're so resilient. And I said, I feel broken. And they said, Ann, how are you so strong? And I said, I am not strong enough. I couldn't seem to navigate it. What do you do when you're down, when you're exhausted, when you are overwhelmed, when you are bombarded with more to do than you can do it, and you're exhausted? Well, I started pouring into the research, and I learned that some of the things that I was doing were contributing to helping me build resilience, and others were hurting it without me even realizing it. I used to think that resilience was in your genetics, kind of like skinny thighs. You either have it or you don't. But what I have come to appreciate is that resilience is a set of skills and habits and behaviors that can be proactively cultivated and practiced and honed. And whether we like it or not, life is going to give us plenty of chances to practice. So while there are many ways to build resilience, today I want to focus on three things that you can do: your mindset, your skill set, and your ability to reset. So let's start with your mindset. How many of you talk to yourselves? All right, so those that didn't raise your hand are sitting there going, do I talk to myself? I think so. Yes, you do. And you listen to yourself too. And it turns out that the stories we've been telling ourselves about ourselves are all wrong. In 1942, scientists at the Wolf Lake Hatchery in Michigan conducted a study with a walleye pike. It's a carnivorous fish. So they take this carnivorous fish and they put it in a tank full of minnows. And as one would anticipate, it ate them. So then the scientists put in another batch of minnows, only this time they encase them in a glass cylinder so that the pike can see the minnows, but it can't get to them. In an attempt to try, it keeps ramming its head against the glass over and over and over again until finally it just settles on the bottom of the tank. So the scientists then release the minnows so that they can swim freely. What do you think the pike did? Nothing. Stayed at the bottom of the tank and died. And this has become known as the pike syndrome. Now, it might not be a glass cylinder, but our fear and our self-limiting beliefs create these imaginary barriers that we are convinced we can't break through. We tell ourselves, I could never do that. I've always wanted to try this. But here's the challenge. Our beliefs drive our behavior, and beliefs can be changed. We create self-limiting barriers for ourselves. And what I want to do now is give you some tools to break through those. And the way that starts is with a cup of coffee, brushing your teeth, and my ex-husband. I'm joking. Your diet. All right. These are all habits. In fact, we are creatures of habit. Over 45% of everything we do every single day is a habit. And our brain depends on these cognitive shortcuts, so it doesn't have to work as hard. Our brain will take anything we repeatedly think, say, or do and convert it into a cognitive shortcut. So have you ever driven past your exit because you're deep in thought? Right? Or finished a meal without even realizing you'd eaten it because you were watching something? Right? If we are not careful, each day becomes the same day, and we end up living on autopilot. And most of us just kind of end up where we're headed, and we draw a bullseye around ourselves and go, okay, I guess this is what it was supposed to look like. My goal is that you create the life you want by defining what it looks like and reverse engineering your life to get there. Don't settle for where you are headed. Create the life you want, and it really starts with your habits. The challenge with our brain is that it doesn't know which habits support our success and which habits sabotage our success. It just takes anything you repeatedly do. So worry can become a habit. Anxiety can become a habit. And because the more you think and behave a certain way, the easier it is to think and behave that way. It's a fancy term. It's called experiential dependent neuroplasticity. And what it means is If you're cranky, the more you are, the easier it is to be cranky. The more you're happy, the easier it is to be happy. The more you find things that are wrong with the world, the easier it is to find those things. And so how do you change that? Well, it starts with the human brain. So our brain has gone through three levels of evolution. And if you imagine your brain like your fist, the first evolution is our reptilian brain. It's at the base of our skull. And this is the part of the brain that's responsible for heart rate, breathing, respiration, balance, things that you don't even really think about. They just happen naturally. The second evolution is tucked in the middle of your brain. It's called your limbic system. This is the emotional cockpit of your brain. It's where your habits and memories and all of your emotions come from. The newest evolution, your neocortex, what separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom, is the outer layer that supports our brain, but specifically the prefrontal cortex right behind your forehead. And this is the part of the brain responsible for innovation, creativity, problem solving, decision making, all the higher level stuff that requires work. So our brain takes anything it has to do really often and makes it habitual. So we'll do an experiment. Cross your arms. Some of you are cold and were there already. Okay. Now cross your arms in the opposite direction. Which way was more awkward, the first time or the second time? The second time, and it's because it happened in different parts of your brain. The first time you crossed your arms, it came from your limbic system. You've done it a million times when you're cold, closed off, angry, upset, or just need a place to rest your hands. The second time you did it, you had to work at it. It came from your prefrontal cortex. And if you had to do that enough times eventually, that would become a habit too. The challenge is our brain doesn't know which habits to adopt, so it only adopts the ones we give it. Your behavior, your belief system, all of those things are habit patterns. Have you ever gone to the grocery store after they have rearranged the shelves? And you get home and you're like, why am I so tired? I just needed peanut butter. It's not that hard, right? It's because it's hard to change habit patterns. And if we're not careful, we just live our life on autopilot and we get stuck in a rut. And a rut is nothing more than a grave with no ends. Rather than end up where we are headed, let's create the life we want. But to do it, it takes courage. It takes courage to change habit patterns because they're comfortable. It requires us to be comfortable getting uncomfortable. And I used to think courage and fear were at opposite ends of the spectrum. I was terrified. How could I be courageous? But what I learned is that sometimes courage means you're afraid and you do it anyway. Sometimes courage means that you roll out of bed, you're exhausted, you barely find two matching shoes, you get in the car, you got kids screaming, you spill coffee on your new shirt, you drop them off, you get to work, you're late, but you show up. Sometimes courage means having a difficult conversation. Hell, trying on a bathing suit is a total act of courage. Yes, right? But my favorite way to look at courage is a definition by Marianne Rademacher, who said, courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes courage is the quiet voice at the end of the day saying, I'll try again tomorrow. And that definition has been my lifeline, because sometimes that's all we can do. People ask me all the time, Anne, how do you stay so motivated? Well, first, my husband will tell you I'm the most pessimistic motivational speaker he's ever met. I called him from the Boston airport last week. I was like, honey, I think I'm gonna miss my flight. He said, Anne, be positive, you're a motivational speaker. And I said, I'm positive I'm going to miss my flight. It's not like I'm out high-fiving sunbeams every day. Unicorns are not farting cupcakes in my bedroom. Doves are not released when I walk into a room. This is a choice, sometimes moment by moment, hour by hour. It's about making the decision about what you want to find, because you find what you look for. I can prove it. How many of you have dated someone where at the beginning of the relationship, you thought this person could be the one? Everything they did was cute. The way they talked was cute. The way they walk is cute. The way they tell stories warms your heart. But somewhere along the way, you figure out this person is not the one, and everything they do drives you crazy. Watching them eat makes you nauseous. How many of you are still married to that person? There's always a couple, right? The person didn't change, what you looked for did. I have a sign on my bathroom mirror that I wrote in blue Sharpie marker that says, what do you want to find today? And then go look for it. Because I spent a lot of time looking for all the reasons my life wasn't fair. Why could my friends bring their kids to the grocery store and mine took down an end cap? How could my friends go see Elmo and my kids smacked him? You know? And I spent a lot of time feeling very sorry for myself until I figured out that we find what we look for. So your mindset, your belief system is your toolbox. It's the place that you start. But your skill set are your tools. And it all starts with this little guy. How many of you have one of these bad boys on you right now? Little device they call your phone, yeah. So here's the thing, the average American spends a year of their life trying to figure out what to watch on TV. We give a 5-inch piece of hardware with absolutely no pulse more time and attention to the people than the people in our lives. The average smartphone user checks their phone every 6 minutes. It's over 150 times a day. You will swipe, tap, or click 2,617 times today. Because people have to know what you're doing, and we got to check our Facebook status and our likes and all of those things. We're so busy trying to get people to like us, we want people we don't like to like us, right? And nobody posts the crappy stuff on Facebook. Everybody posts their highlight reel. You could be having a fight in the kitchen, and all of a sudden it's like, hold on, smile, and then we got to post it on Facebook. And then we compare our life that way. I can't go on Facebook the first week of school because all my friends are posting pictures with their happy kiddos, and mine is in the driveway throwing a fit and won't get on the bus, right? You know what you don't see? You don't see me, I'll post today. I'll post all about this. This is so exciting. I'm thrilled to be here. And you'll see me post pictures and Facebook Live and all kinds of stuff. You know what you won't see me post? On Monday morning, what woke me up out of a dead sleep before I left for the airport. Now, how many of you have pets? All right, so you know there is no sound that can wake you out of a dead sleep quite like this one. Right? And it's always on carpet. I don't care where you are. It's on carpet. There could be a divider, and it's on the carpet. You won't see me post that. You won't see me post the fight I had with my husband next to the dishwasher for the 18th time over how to properly load silverware. It's not that hard, right? People post the best versions of themselves, and then we compare ourselves to others. The rate of suicide, self-medication, and depression is higher in the Western world than any place on Earth. Antidepressants have gone up 400% since 1987. Now, no judgment. I'm on everything but roller skates, right? However, what we know is that there are things we can do, and it all starts with our mindset, and part of that is our belief about stress. So I'm going to ask you two questions, and these were the two questions asked when they studied 30,000 Americans to identify the way that stress impacts our health. So the first question, in the last 12 months, what level of stress have you had, low, moderate, or high? Raise your hand if in the last 12 months you've had low levels of stress. Okay. Raise your hand if in the last 12 months you've had moderate levels of stress. Raise your hand if you've had high levels of stress. Look around the room. Okay. Now, raise your hand if you think stress is bad for you. All right, so here's the good news and the bad news. Bad news is, for the people who had high levels of stress in the previous 12 months, they had a 43% increased risk of dying prematurely. However, it was only the people that thought stress was bad for them. The people who thought stress was just their body creating the cortisol, the adrenaline, the energy they needed to deal with the task at hand, that their body was just preparing them, they had a 0% increased risk of dying prematurely, less than the people who had low levels of stress. And what we know about this is that they did cardiac profiles. They looked at these people while they were going through stressful simulations. And the people who had high levels of stress and thought stress was bad for them, their arteries constricted, limiting blood flow to the heart and to the brain. For people who were undergoing high levels of stress but thought it was just their body's way of preparing them, they had zero constriction. They had the same cardiac profile as people who are experiencing joy and courage. According to this research, it is not stress that is killing us. It is our belief that stress is bad for us, that it is killing us. And here's why. When we believe stress is bad for us, we try to numb. We try to run away. Maybe if I have a few glasses of wine, or I go out, or I watch 18 episodes of Scandal, or whatever I use to numb, sex, drugs, rock and roll, whatever your vice of choice is, right? But when you feel like stress is just your body preparing you for action, you start to figure out, how do I give myself more fuel? How do I prepare myself even more? And you tend to make healthier choices and cope differently. Your belief system drives your behavior, and I want to prove it to you. I need a volunteer, somebody who's, we don't have a ton of time, so I need someone. Come on up, quick. You get to win one of my books. I am so grateful you did not just fall, because I would have. All right, tell me your name.
Becky.
Becky, are you right-handed or left-handed? Okay, so come stand over here. Becky, I'm going to ask you to be a little bit vulnerable here, because whatever happens in ballroom F stays in ballroom F. All right. So, Becky, like, all of us have this negative self-talk when we're stressed out. Like, we wear busy as a badge of honor. Like, I'm exhausted, I'm burned out, I can't do it, I'm overwhelmed. What are the messages you say to yourself when you're stressed out?
Don't be.
Okay. But what are the negative things you say to yourself about yourself? Vulnerably right here, I'm asking you to come clean.
I would say you shouldn't feel this way. You're not enough. You're too much.
You're not enough, or you're too much, or you shouldn't feel this way. Now, I told my daughter to do this, and I said, honey, she's 17 now. I said, what do you say to yourself when you're trying to pump yourself up? And she goes, you want me to say it now? And I said, yeah. And she said, out loud? And I said, yes. And she said, I'm not going to get in trouble. And I was like, good Lord, honey, what do you say to yourself? And she stood in our kitchen and went, I'm a badass bitch. And I was like, that's my girl. That's my girl. All right. What do you say to yourself when you're trying to pump yourself up?
I mostly just jump around.
Yeah, but what do you say? What are the messages? There's messages coming into your brain.
That I'm enough.
That I'm enough.
And I'm good, and I'm awesome.
I'm awesome. I can do this. I'm enough. I have a plaque in my office that says, let whatever you do today be enough. And I wholly believe that. So I want you to put your arm down out. Becky, do you work out? Okay, well, here's what I want you to do. I'm going to push on your arm, and I want you to resist. Do not let me push down your arm. Do you understand? Okay, ready? Becky, you're like a tree. Ooh, okay, I tried my hardest. All right, now we're going to resist again. And this time I want you to say, I can't, I'm not enough, whatever your negative self-talk is. And as soon as you start saying those things, I'm going to push down, and I want you to resist. Are you ready? You're saying them out loud, and as soon as you start, and resist.
Okay?
Go for it.
I'm not enough. Ooh.
You wanna try it again? Try harder this time, Becky. All right, ready?
I can't do it, I'm not enough.
All right, okay. Now put your arm out, and I want you to say the things you say to yourself when you're trying to pump yourself up, and you can use my daughter's expression if you want, but I want you to resist, okay? And I'll start pushing when you start talking.
I'm a badass bitch.
Oh, good job, Becky, here. All right, so they don't have my first book in the bookstore, so if I were you, I'd take that one. They have this one there, but you get to choose which one you want. All right, girl, thank you. Give her a hand, everybody. And I did this with my daughter, and she's like, come on, you're priming my brain and the blah, blah, blah. And I said, don't even tell me what you're thinking. Just think it. And it works because your beliefs drive your behavior and your neurochemistry forms to match. We believe the things we tell ourselves. How many of you go home and someone says, hey, how was your day? And you say, I had a neutral day. It was absolutely neutral. No, we either go home and say, it was a horrible day, I'm exhausted, I'm tired, now I have to start my second shift with the kids or the errands or the whatever, or we say, I had a great day. Your brain believes what you tell it. When you say things like, I'm exhausted, I'm tired, I'm busy, how many of you wear a busy badge? Like it's a Girl Scout button, right? We are busier than we have ever been. Busy does not equal productive. Busy equals exhausted. Your brain believes what you tell it. And when you say things like, I'm tired, I'm exhausted, I'm overwhelmed, and I'm stressed out, your brain starts to default and that becomes your habit pattern. Now, you don't have to go from I'm exhausted, I'm drained, I'm stressed out to this is the best day ever. I'd have 10 more like them if I could. But you can go from I'm exhausted to it is what it is. I'll get through it and there'll be tomorrow. Right? It's little subtle shifts in behavior and belief system. And that's really at the root of resilience. Are you cultivating the habits, the thoughts, and the belief systems that are going to create the life you want? Or are you willing to settle for the life that you're going to get based on how you think and behave now? And it is a choice that only you can make. So people will tell you if you're studying resilience, you want to be focused on healthcare and self-care. And I had a friend, her name is Bridget, and she's like, Ann, you got to try hot yoga and kale smoothies. Amazing, will change your life. And I'm like, Bridget, I don't like room temperature yoga, so I seriously doubt I'm going to like hot yoga. And kale is kind of like hairy spinach or wet sadness. I just don't get it, whatever. That wasn't for me. And everybody kept telling me, Ann, you gotta take care of you. And I thought, okay, in between raising two kids, one of whom is a little woo-woo, a husband, a full-time business and career, trying to be a volunteer, have a social life, and still be sexy, fit, and fun, I'll go ahead and take a spa day. But it turns out that when you don't take time to do those things for yourself, life has a way of doing them for you. Now, my mom was a court reporter for 30 years, had her own court reporting agency. And at the age of 51, she became a flight attendant. And she just turned 70, and she is still doing it. And I'm not supposed to tell you which airline, so we'll just call it Southwest. So my mom does these amazing announcements, and my favorite is the one for the oxygen mask. And she'll say, in case of a sudden loss of cabin pressure, please place your mask on first and then assist your child. And if you're traveling with more than one child, please pick your favorite or the one with the most potential. That's my mama. All right, there's a reason they tell you to put your mask on first. I was too busy to take time to put my mask on. When Evan was 10 years old, we had to hospitalize him again. And this time I had to fly to Iowa to give a keynote speech in the dead of winter, and I was exhausted and I felt guilty for leaving. And I got to the Austin airport and I had a migraine, like the horrible kind that make you sick to your stomach and see spots. It was miserable. And my flight was delayed by 3 hours, so I did something I swore I would never do. I went to one of those crazy expensive chair massage places. It's like $100 a minute. It's crazy. So I put my head in the cradle and I just lose my mind. I just start to sob, and the massage therapist asks what's going on, and I just proceed to tell her everything. And her name was Becky, and she said, Ann, here's the deal. When you come home from your trip, I have a child who has special needs, and he's in the school district your son is in. I want to do something for you. It's time someone did something for you. I'm going to come to your house and give you a 90-minute massage, my treat. Take my card. Call me when you get home. So note to self, if you are ever in the Austin Bergstrom Airport, cry uncontrollably and ask for Becky. She's amazing. So Becky came to my house and she gave me one of the best massages I've ever had. And when she left, she said, hey, just a heads up, you've got a swollen lymph node behind your ear. You've been crying a lot. It's pretty common. Get it checked out. So I did. They did a CAT scan and gave me antibiotics. And we're checking Evan out of the hospital 2 months later, not because he was better, but because insurance would only provide that long. And we got a call from my doctor. And my doctor said, Ann, are you sitting down? And I said, no. And he said, well, you might want to. It's not a lymph node. It's a tumor in your salivary gland. It's traveling towards your brain, and we have to get it out now. Now, my son had just been discharged from a pediatric psych hospital. And I told my doctor, I said, look, you don't understand. I have to be in Bangalore for a speaking engagement in July. This was late February. I don't have time for a tumor. And he did his best Arnold Schwarzenegger voice, and he's like, sorry, it's a tumor. And I'm like, okay, not funny. So he tells me, Ann, look, don't worry about it. It's a two-hour surgery. We'll be in and out. You'll be back to speaking and training and doing your stuff in no time. Don't you worry at all. So before he rolls me back into the surgery, which sounded much like that, he says, Ann, do you have anything you want to say? And I said, yeah, don't it up. Like, I have stuff to do. So 6.5 hours into this two-hour surgery, the doctor comes out and asks my mom and husband to have a seat. And he explains that the tumor was much larger than anticipated. Instead of the size of a dime, it was the size of a small avocado. And my facial nerve had stretched over it so much so that when I woke up, the right side of my face was completely paralyzed. I drooled, I had a speech impediment, I couldn't close my eye. So 2 days later, while I was waiting for my eye patch, a speck of dust scratched my cornea. And the doctor said, Ann, well, we have to put a gold weight into your upper eyelid, we have to stitch up your bottom eyelid, we don't anticipate your facial nerve recovering, so we need to do that before you start 6 weeks of radiation. So my mom, being the flight attendant that she is, said, hey, honey, why don't you take a couple of my passes and you and Jay can go somewhere for the weekend. And we thought, well, since we've been so lucky lately, let's go to Vegas. So we did, and we're walking down the stairs towards Caesar's Palace. I had taken my picture with a minion. Half my face looked like angry all the time. Half my face looked happy. It was a giant mess. And I turned to him as we're walking down the stairs and I said, honey, this is the best I have felt since the surgery. I am finally starting to feel good again. And then because I had no depth perception, I proceeded to fall down the stairs and break my foot in four places. You can't make this shit up. So there I am at the Vegas airport. I got a boot on one foot, a patch over my eye, half a face, and I'm like, oh. And the security dude was like, guys, let her through. She's been through enough, right? But the truth is, life is messy, and it's there to teach us if we're willing to let it. I believe that whether you call it faith or God or will, I believe that a combination of those made my face return. They told me it was not possible to come back during radiation. And during my fourth week of radiation, my husband started counting teeth, which meant that my smile was stabilizing. And during my fifth week of radiation, my eyes started to twitch. Now, my passport still has my face all jacked up because I did go to India. But now when I go to the airport and travel internationally, they look at me and I have to go, hold on. And they're like, oh, you look way better now. Thanks. Right? Our life is a series of challenges and obstacles. It's not what happens. It's how we choose to respond to it, what we do to interpret that. I learned that self-care is not selfish. It is a requirement for resilience. You cannot be there for others if you are not there for yourself. And it doesn't have to be a spa day. It can be strategically stopping throughout your day and asking yourself, am I reacting my way through my day or am I in charge of it? Am I just operating out of my inbox, fighting one fire after the next? Or am I being deliberate about how and where I invest my time? Are you creating the life you want, or are you living the one that you just habitually have? Self-care could be not eating lunch at your desk, because guess what? People who do have a hugely increased risk of diabetes and heart disease. And if you think you can't get up during lunch, think again, because you are incredibly much more productive if you take a few minutes to go walk around your building or take a flight of stairs. You don't have to exercise like crazy. They found that 120 minutes a week, even if you do it all in one sitting, is enough to change your brain and grow back gray matter that's damaged by stress. And gray matter is the part of your brain responsible for emotional regulation and attention management. 50 to 70 million Americans have a sleep or wakefulness disorder, so much so that the CDC has named it our number one health epidemic. But yet, we are like, well, I'll sleep when I'm dead. I don't have time to sleep. Right? You don't have time not to. Your body is sending you signals. Our brain can't be on full steam ahead all the time. You have to put yourself in airplane mode. What do? We're in the elevator. Well, I don't want to talk to people. Take out your phone. We're waiting in line for the escalator. I don't want to network. Take out your phone. In the bathroom stall, ladies, you know what to do, right? You stop at a red light. I have time to knock out a quick email. And we have lost the art of being still. We're so afraid to be still with our thoughts that in the absence of it, we go to our phone. And then we start comparing ourselves to everybody else on Facebook. You know why you like going on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter to see how many people retweeted you or liked you or commented on you? Because every time you do, you get something called a dopamine squirt. Now, I know it sounds dirty, but it's not. You get a rush of dopamine, that feel-good neurochemical and antidepressants, and so our brain becomes addicted to it. And then we gotta start looking, how many likes, how many followers, how many this, how many that. Is it getting you any closer to living the life you want? Or are you just doing it out of habit? Because that's just what we do. What we know is that people who practice resilience proactively cultivate positive emotions like gratitude and optimism. Now, we used to think optimism was a personality trait, unchangeable. Now we know that that is not the case. The needle is movable. My mother-in-law lives on the East Coast, and I love her so much, but she has a tendency to be somewhat negative. So she, a few months ago, moved into an elderly community, and I called her. I said, Nancy, how are you? And she goes, I'm horrible. I'm horrible. My apartment is the size of a matchbox. I can't even walk around here. Nothing good is going to happen in this apartment. And I said, can you think of anything positive? She goes, yeah, I'm going to die soon and not have to live in this apartment. And I was like, all right, that's not what I had in mind. I'm going to call you back tomorrow, Mom, and I want you to tell me one positive thing that has happened to you or one positive thing you can do to create this situation. So I call her back the next day. She's like, Ann, I thought about this all day. I came up with something positive. And I'm like, all right, lay it on me. And she goes, well, Doris lives in apartment 3B. Doris's apartment is 5 times the size of my apartment. I could have a party in there. It's crazy big. And I said, so what's the good news? And she said, Doris is very, very sick. I said, Mom, that is not the way this is supposed to work. But guess who's living in 3B? Right? Optimism doesn't mean you wear rose-colored glasses. It doesn't mean bad stuff doesn't happen. It means you choose how you interpret that. You choose how you interpret what you're going to do with it. Are you going to learn from it, or are you going to let it bury you? Right? And most of us run from negative emotions. We feel fear or sadness or hurt or anger, and we're like, nope, I shouldn't feel those, and we try to numb them. And what we know is that that makes them come out sideways. They come out in horrible ways that impact your relationships, your career, and your life. It is okay. Not only is it not okay, it is necessary to sit in uncomfortable emotions. You don't have to marinate in them, but you got to give yourself permission to stay there. Most of us are passive aggressive. We look upset. You doing okay? I'm fine. And I always want to say, good, tell your face. Right? We get to choose what we want to do. Now, gratitude has been found to be the number one predictor of well-being and a strong determinant of resilience. Simply looking for something to be grateful for. You don't even have to find anything. Just looking for something to be grateful for releases serotonin and dopamine, the feel-good neurotransmitters, and it decreases cortisol, the stress hormone, by 23%. Just looking. But I have found most of us are so busy trying to find a constant state of happy that we miss these micro moments. Gallup did a study where they took 4 million employees and they looked at the impact of receiving regular praise and recognition, and they found that it was one of the largest determinants of job satisfaction and success. So how many of you go home at the end of the day and say, if one more person appreciates me, I quit. If I get one more compliment, I'm done. No, it doesn't. And what we know about gratitude is that when you start priming your brain to look for those things, you're more likely to find them. I call them delicious moments. So you remember storybooks, right? When we were a kid, or if you have kids, the little golden books, they all end with one sentence. And they lived happily ever after. Worst sentence ever written on a page. Because then you go through a divorce, or you lose a job, or you get sick, or you have a sick kid, and all of a sudden you're like, well, clearly I failed. Only there is no constant state of happy. Happiness is not a trait, it's a skill. And there is no all or none. It happens in micro moments. I call them delicious moments. It's the first sip of coffee. It's a snuggle with your animals. It's a belly laugh that leaves you gasping for breath. It's a joke that someone tells you. It's just that moment when you wake up and you get to realize you have 10 more minutes to go back to sleep. These are these little micro moments. I have a whole board in my office called my delicious moment board, and I'll hang my name tag and pictures of the conference on there, because here's what happens. When you identify it and put it there, you get a dopamine squirt. But then, inevitably, I have so many things that go up on that wall. If I laugh at a restaurant, I write it on a cocktail napkin and I thumbtack it to my wall. I have sticky notes, pictures, name tags, you name it. But what ends up happening is that you go back to it later and you re-experience all of that joy again. We're having a gratitude challenge in our company right now. All you have to do is find us on social and send us something you're grateful for. And the week of Thanksgiving, we're giving away a $250 gift card or a donation to the charity of your choice. And all you have to do is start looking for things that you're grateful for, because when you look for them, you are more likely to find them. Now, this next strategy people kept telling me to do, and I thought, oh my Lord, really? I am not gonna sit in a full lotus, find my Zen, and eat tofu. It's just not me. Like, I tried to meditate, and it was playing whack-a-mole with my thoughts. I would sit there and be like, okay, Anne, breathe. What am I gonna make for dinner? Okay, Anne, breathe. Why does my leg itch? What did I sit in? Do I have a rash? Screw it. I'd be done. Until I learned that that means it's working. So there's a difference between mindfulness and meditation. Mindfulness simply means you are where you are when you're there. My kids call me on this. I teach this stuff, and I'll ask them how their day is and look down at my phone. Right? Be where you are when you're there. Harvard found we spend 47% of our time thinking about something other than what we're doing right now. How many of you have thought about something other than what I'm talking about? Every single one of you better raise your hands. I've thought about things other than what I'm gonna talk about, right? Like, that is what our brain is designed to do. Mindfulness means you're not spending all your time worried about the past. You're not spending your time ruminating on stuff that could happen in the future. You're focused on the here and now. Now, meditation, I don't know where along the line I learned that it was supposed to be calm and zen-like. It is anything but. Your mind does not stop racing. Buddhist monks call it your monkey mind. And meditation is nothing more than brain training. You are training your brain to direct its attention where you want it rather than where it goes naturally. So every time I downloaded an app to learn how to do it, and 9 minutes a day grows gray matter in your brain. And every time your mind wanders, which it will every single moment, and you bring it back to your breath, you're training your brain. So when I lay in bed at night and I start ruminating on my day, I meditate to sleep. And after 30 or 40 breaths, you get bored. And you're just like, screw it, I'll go to sleep, right? It's these little things, celebrating those delicious moments. It's being present. It's, you know, you have so many things competing for your time and attention. The biggest gift you can give someone is your full attention. And it's so rare now. You're on the phone folding laundry, chewing gum, thinking about what you have to do tomorrow, sending emails. I love what Elizabeth Gilbert said. You know, pick the things and the people that really matter, right? And spend your time and energy there. So this next strategy, I'm going to give you a second to let this sink in because it's a twofer. So this combines two of my favorite strategies, humor and social connection. Now humor, a true smile that involves the muscles around your eyes, actually cools your heart, slows respiration, and calms your nervous system. A genuine laugh creates the same brain activity as 2,000 chocolate bars. We'll test it. Does an 85-year-old man wear boxers or briefs? Depends. You didn't even need that brownie at dessert. You just had a flood of 2,000 chocolate bars of dopamine, right? We know that social connection is a greater predictor of how long you will live than smoking, obesity, and high blood pressure combined. More people died last year of loneliness than of all of those three things combined. Who are you surrounding yourself with? If everybody else around you is negative and has drama, identify the common denominator. We train people how to treat us. And I have a lot of people say, I don't know what to do. Everybody keeps coming to me with their drama. And I said, stop listening. Right? We train people. Support yourself with people who lift you up. Form a tribe of people that are going to celebrate your idiosyncrasies and weirdness. Because guess what? We all have it. And if anyone tells you they've got this whole thing figured out, they're full of it. I used to get really hurt when other people didn't like me. Until two things happened. One, I realized that their opinions are none of my business. And two, that 90% of the way people behave toward others is based on how they feel about themselves. So if you have someone in your life who is not very nice, feel for them because they are struggling. They do not like themselves very much, and it's the only way they can express that. So we've talked about your skills. We've talked about your toolbox. Now it's time to figure out how we reset. So we had an in-home caregiver for Evan for 6 years, 20 hours a week, 30 hours a week. And Michael, his name was Michael, and he was from Tanzania, Africa. And every time Evan would have a blow up, he would say, Evan, go to your side of the house and reset. Mother and father, go to your side of the house and reset. And he would literally send us to different sides of the house and tell us to think about things that bring us joy, think about our goals, where we want to end up. And it was his belief system that every day you get to reset as many times as you want. A reset is a choice. And so here's how I've learned to do that. Now, I swim. It's the only exercise that I don't hate. Plus, I've got two titanium pins in my left foot, Jimmy Buffett concert, coconut bra, long story, and it's the same foot I broke in Vegas. So I don't run or jog or play tennis, but I swim. And I swim in a pool, and there's a line so that I can go straight. What happens if you try to swim in a straight line in the ocean? You get carried away by the tide and the current. So you're taught, if you're an open water swimmer, aim for an immovable object like a buoy or a lighthouse. Life is like an ocean. There are some days where the waves are calm and you hear the birds and the sun is shining, and there are days where it is stormy and you are getting sucked under. And if you don't have a North Star, if you don't have something that is your why, your purpose, your passion, your reason for being, you will end up where you are headed. You can have short-term lighthouses. It could be a long weekend away. It could be lunch with a friend. Or you could have long-term lighthouses. You want to change the world. But have a lighthouse. So here's how I do that. Every month I sit down and have a glass or four of wine. I'm joking. It's vodka. And I go through this activity, and I'll tell you how to get this in just a second. But I go through this activity, and I set a goal in one area, not every area. We can't be all things all the time. One area. Maybe I play a board game with my kids instead of watching a movie. It's little things. Little subtle changes add up, like you heard this morning, the 1%. Right? It's those little changes. So if you would like a copy of the self-care sheet and a resilience self-assessment and a poem that I wrote while stranded in an airport for 9 hours, as well as to receive a monthly blog about building resilience, then you can opt in or out of the monthly thing, but you can text 555-888 and write in the word strength. So before I close out, I want to take a few minutes to open it up for questions, and then I'll give you my closing thoughts. But what I'd love to do, and you're going to have to speak loud, and we have microphones, it looks like, on either side. Who has a question? Yes, ma'am. Nice and loud. I will share that in a minute as I close. I'll tell you. Thank you for asking. Thank you for asking. I promise I'll get there. Yes. So the question is, how do you teach your kids this stuff, right? How do you start incorporating this? Well, my daughter is a senior in high school, and last year a junior in her school got stabbed in the neck and killed by 2 eighth graders over a vape pen. Another jumped from the 3rd-floor balcony and killed himself. And they started to realize mental health in schools is pretty darn important. And so every morning we do deep breaths. She does them in her classroom before she starts her day. One of the things I tell her, and I do this in business meetings when I feel myself getting hijacked by all those emotions, I take 5. You take a deep breath in and hold it, and a deep breath release. And you take 5. You do it all the way up your fingers. Inhale deeply, hold, exhale deeply. Inhale deeply, hold, exhale deeply. And you can do this under a desk. 3 deep breaths reset your entire nervous system. And we have a gratitude jar on our counter. And I said, honey, I want you to start every day putting something in this jar. She said, that's so stupid. So she came home the next day. She goes, I had to look my whole day for something to be grateful for. That's the point. Right? It's shifting your perspective. And so if I had known what I know now, I would have started my kids meditating and breathing and focusing on self-care. But I'll tell you, my daughter is a senior, and she'll say, I really need a self-care day. And she's a perfectionist, and she's studying to become a nurse, and she's really hard on herself, and she'll say, I really need a mental health day. Please. And we know that that means she really needs a mental health day. But what do most of us do? Come on, suck it up. You don't have any reason to be stressed. Wait till you're an adult. It only gets worse. And then our kids are disillusioned, depressed, and no better because we've not validated them. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, so the question was, do I believe in vision boards? And in my first book, I talk about that because on my vision board in my office, I had a picture of an avocado to represent the tumor with a slash through it. And I had a picture of a big, beautiful smile. I also have a picture of me standing next to a picture of Brené Brown because she's my work crush. So someday that's going to happen. I did get to speak with her at a conference. You know, and one of the most impactful things that, so I do, I absolutely do. I got to speak at a conference with Michelle Obama, and she said something that will stick with me forever. She said, balance begins by believing you're worth it. Balance begins by believing that you are just as, if not more important than all the people you're trying to be for, do for, and help. You've got to be worth it. So here's what I want to try before I completely wrap up, and I will, am happy to answer more questions, but I want you to pretend like that clock is directly above your head, and I want you to point your index finger up at the ceiling. And I want you to pretend like that clock is right above you, and you're going to trace that clock going faster than a clock would go to the right. So clockwise, okay? All right, you guys look silly. Now, while you're doing that, I want you to lower your arm down just below your chest. All right, now what direction is your clock going? She's a wizard. Clockwise? Counterclockwise. Now there'll be people walking around the hall all day going, I don't get it. You'll see people in the bathroom stall. There's still people in the back doing it. I'll give you a hint. Your direction did not change. What did? Your perspective. And sometimes that's what resilience is all about. How do you interpret what's happening to you? So I wish I could tell you I have it all figured out. The truth is, Evan is 16 years old now, and last July we had to make a gut-wrenching decision to place him at a therapeutic boarding school in Idaho. We could not provide the level of safety and structure that he needed. Now, I see him every month. I talk to him every single day. Last night, I had one of the best conversations with him I've ever had in his whole life. And what I know is that while it's not perfect, it is what it is, and all I can do is all I can do. And when people say, like, just try your best, well, for a perfectionist, that's horrible advice, because you never feel like you're giving it your 100% best. So I changed it to, you know what, all I can do is all I can do. I am doing what I can do. You know, I wish I could tell you that I never have down days, but that's a lie. Everybody does. You got to let yourself feel that and be there to be able to experience the good stuff. But I hear all these women saying, I just want to put on a happy face so everybody thinks everyone's fine. Let people be there to lift you, right? We have to be there for each other, not each other's competition. Not judgmental zone. Do you see what she's wearing? I'm from Texas, so all you have to say is bless her heart. And it can follow anything you say. She's crazy. Bless her heart, right? The truth is, when you are lying on your deathbed, are you going to be happy with the life you had? What will you regret if you don't start making changes now? Because guys, I gotta tell you, we are really good at prioritizing our schedule. We suck at scheduling our priorities. If I tracked your time for a week, would it be representative of what you say is most important to you? Because I can tell you my health is important, but guess what? At the end of a long day, I might not have time to exercise, but guess what I do have time for? Law and Order, SVU, because I like my crimes especially heinous. There's always time for Olivia Benson, always, right? Your resume and your eulogy should not be the same thing. Nobody is going to stand at your deathbed and be like, damn, she worked 80 hours a week, rock star. What are you going to regret? The average person experiences 5 to 6 traumas in a lifetime, right? That's a lot of trauma. And we learn from it. We look back with perspective. We might have seen it at the time, but we look back with perspective. It's actually called post-traumatic growth. And the lessons are there if we are willing to let them. Every single thing that does not defeat you, every scar is a reminder of what you have overcome. Everything that doesn't take you down can be added to the database of things that did not defeat you. You have a choice about your habits, your beliefs, your skills, and your behaviors. And don't try to change them all at once, because that's like New Year's resolutions. By January 15th, you have a beer in one hand, a cheeseburger in the other. You went to the gym, that hurt. Why would I do that again? And you go right back to what you were doing before, right? This is about one decision at a time, one choice at a time. It's about living the life you deserve. I want my daughter not to just live in a world where she has a seat at the table. I want her to live in a world where she has a voice at that table. I want to create the world, and I want us to do that for our kids so that they don't have to worry about gender equity, so that they're not worried about how they're treated based on who they are or what they look like. That is what we have the power to do together. So I have a couple more minutes. I want to open it up to more questions. Yes, ma'am, in the blue shirt right there. I can't hear you. Yes, at the book table. I have to like run out of here. Last time I didn't run out on time and I was late to my book signing. So yes, the answer is yes. And
if you do have a question, can you please come up to one of the mics so that we can hear everyone in the room?
Oh yeah, thank you. Oh, because it's also being simulcast so other people can hear it. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. So my question has to do with a good friend of mine who she's married, she has 2 children, but she's the main breadwinner for her household. She has a lot of pressure at work. She doesn't get a lot of support from her family. They've had some recent issues. And she doesn't feel very supported by her husband either, from a financial standpoint or an emotional standpoint. Recently, she took some time off of work to try to take care of herself because she was feeling very overwhelmed. I told her that was the right thing to do, to take care of herself. She can't take care of others. She has to take care of herself first before she can take care of others. I guess my question would be, what sort of advice can I give her when, you know, I think you can't control what others around you are doing. You can only control yourself. But what kind of encouragement can I give her in that situation where there are all these moving pieces and she can't really control them?
Yeah, I wish there was a simple formula. A plus B always equals C, right? But I would say you train people how to treat you, and you can either change your behavior or your expectations. Because most of us end up disappointed when they don't align,
right?
So either change the situation by changing your behavior or settle for the situation and change your expectations. But you can't change her for her. You can be supportive and loving, but sometimes you also gotta be the friend who's gonna give her a swift kick in the ass.
Yeah.
Like, what are you gonna do to change your life?
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Yes?
We talk a lot about self-care, and I'm curious what you do in your life to actually block out your time for you.
So I swim at least 3 days a week when I'm home. If I'm traveling, I'll make sure I go to the gym at the hotel, even if I have to wake up earlier. And I am not one of those people who, like, I love to run. I get a runner's high. I hate exercise. But I always feel really great afterwards, and I'm proud of myself because it's like eating my frog. I get the first thing done. I practice gratitude every day. I meditate every single day. And I don't always get it perfectly. There are days I'll come home and I'll be like, honey, I'm so tired. And he was like, hey, this is an opportunity for growth. And I'm like, don't use my own shit on me. That's not funny. You know, we're all doing the best we can, but I incorporate it as much as I can every day. And then I give myself permission to be human and give myself grace when I screw it up.
And how do you protect that time?
Well, you can't always. There are some days where there are things out of your control. I got a call the other morning from my daughter's school. She was sick. I had to go get her, and I couldn't swim, so I swam that night. You know, there are times when you guard that window, but put it in your calendar. People aren't going to schedule a meeting with you when you have a time blocked off for strategic thinking or a meeting that you put on there. Put, like, a fake name on there that you're having a meeting with, right? You don't have to attend every meeting you're invited to. You don't go to every party you're invited to. Tentatively accept and find out if you have to be there. We train people how to treat us. Take the time. And when you can't, forgive yourself.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. All right, I think we have time for one more. Yes. Yes, and self-compassion is one of the biggest determinants of resilience, right? We treat ourselves and talk to ourselves in ways we would never talk to our best friend. If you had a loudspeaker playing out loud what you have said to yourself so far today, most of us would be ashamed. You would never say those things to your best friend. I've done it today. I can't believe I said that, did that, ate that, wore that. Come on, we all do it. We're human. But you would never say things to your friends that you say to yourself. So change the tape. Switch it off the history channel in your brain and start creating the future that you want one thought at a time. It is subtle changes. That's all it is. Subtle, consistent changes. You're welcome. Ladies, thank you so much for your time and your attention. I appreciate it very, very much. I hope to see you at the book table.
Awesome job, Anne. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. Anne will be signing books after this, so please make your way outside if you are interested in attending. Just a quick note, too. The audio of all the breakout sessions on the conference website in about a week, so make sure you check the app or the program for additional details. Have a good day, everyone.